welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. I wanted to add a special note at the start of this episode because so much has happened in the world in the past couple weeks. Time seems to be moving at warp speed, which is a little bit difficult to manage with this podcast since my guests are often booked months in advance of when you actually hear the episode. And I usually record the episodes at least 4 weeks in advance of air date, and sometimes even more. This particular episode was recorded on May 14th, which was 11 days before George Floyd was killed and many protests for racial justice followed. So I wanted to timestamp this episode to provide the appropriate context for my discussion with my guest. I also wanted to share that I'll be airing a bonus episode available to all listeners, highlighting some of my favorite books by Black authors next Wednesday, which is June 17th, and was originally slated to be an off week for the podcast. Like many of us in the book world, I have realized over the past couple weeks that I have a lot of work to do as far as reading more diversely, particularly reading more books by Black authors, and also featuring more books by Black authors on my blog and Instagram feed, and authors of color, and specifically Black authors, as guests on my podcast. I'm committed to doing this work. I've already begun doing some reading, and I will be sharing my progress on the blog and in my other forums. All right, let's get to the episode featuring Kimberly McCreet, author of A Good Marriage, who I thoroughly enjoyed talking to. Hey everyone, welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I am thrilled to welcome one of my go-to mystery thriller authors, Kimberly McCreet, to the show today. Kimberly is the author of May Book of the Month pick, A Good Marriage. Her debut novel, New York Times bestseller Reconstructing Amelia, was nominated for an Edgar Award, an Anthony, and an Alex Award, and was called Entertainment Weekly's Favorite Book of the Year. Reconstructing Amelia was optioned by Nicole Kidman's Blossom Films, and A Good Marriage is in development with Blossom and Amazon Studios. Her second adult novel, Where They Found Her, was a USA Today bestseller and a Kirkus Best Mystery of the Year. She is also the author of the New York Times bestselling YA trilogy called The Outliers. She attended Vassar College and graduated cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and two daughters. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really happy to be here.
Well, I am thrilled to talk to you. And before we get started on digging deep, tell everybody a little bit about what A Good Marriage is about, just for the listeners who have not had a chance to read it yet.
Yeah, so A Good Marriage is set in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which is my neighborhood, and it takes place over 1 week in the summer when the kids are all the way at sleepaway camp mostly, and their parents are gearing up for the event of the summer, which is an adults-only party with a sexually adventurous side to it. It's sexually adventurous but fun. Every year it's always just been meant in good fun, but after this year's party, a woman ends up dead. Her husband is quickly accused, and he reaches out to a former law school classmate named Lizzie for help. And Lizzie, whose own marriage is faltering, is drawn into Park Slope, and she quickly realizes that neither her friend nor his wife were who they appeared to be, but then neither is her husband. So the book is really part legal thriller, part domestic suspense, but it is also meant to be a genuine exploration of what it means to sustain a marriage over time and the secrets some couples keep and the compromises they make in order to stay together, whatever the cost.
And I absolutely loved it. And I have to tell you, my audience knows this already about me, but I have to tell you, I'm usually very nitpicky about my thrillers. You are an author that has never once failed me.
Oh, thank you. That's the best compliment.
I've loved all three of your adult novels. And I have figured out that I particularly love thrillers that have either a heavy legal angle or a heavy psychological angle. And A Good Marriage, I feel like, has both, but predominantly the legal angle. And obviously that makes sense since you got your law degree and you practiced for a while. Can you tell us how and or why you made the switch from being a lawyer to writing novels?
You know, I came to writing rather late to begin with. I mean, I didn't write my first short story till high school. And I had a lot of encouragement from a high school writing teacher. She was like, you have to be a writer. But to be honest, I had came from a bit of a troubled family background. And so I knew that I absolutely was going to need to be able to support myself. And the idea of being a writer sounded really absurd. I was like, that's not a thing people do. It's like
risky.
A job, right? Like just really risky and all of those things and uncertain. And my teenage self was very right. It's all of those things. So I was correct about that, but I really just kind of avoided it. And I really focused on what kind of careers I could pursue that would give me that security. And I went to Vassar College, which is a place where people are very creative. A lot of people had already published short stories when I arrived there as freshmen. So I avoided it there too. So I loved law school. Law school is fantastic, particularly if you go to like a national law school like I did. You really just sit around and talk about legal theory and social justice, and it's really great. But then you graduate and you have to actually, you know, practice law. So it wasn't until I had graduated, I got a very good job. I had my New York City apartment, and I was really like, oh my God, is this actually what I am supposed to do for the rest of my life? And then I started asking myself, really, what did I want to do? What would make me happy? And really, there's no way to learn to write a novel but to write one. So I took a leave of absence. You know, I was lucky enough to be able to take a leave of absence for the year, live off of savings. I deferred my law school loans. I mean, I had to pay for law school, so it cost me $250,000 to go to law school. So I was able to do that, though, and do it with the security of knowing I had this good, really good job to come back to. And I was like, I'm going to write a book in a year. I'm going to get an agent. I'm going to sell it. This is going to be great. I don't care how much money I can sell it for no money, but I still won't, you know, as long as it's enough, I'll go, I'll wait tables and I'll be a writer. And so I took that year and I did write the book in the year, and I got a really kind of good agent at a big agency, and he almost sold that book, which is pretty incredible looking back, but he didn't. There was a couple of editors who wanted to buy it, but they couldn't convince their publishers. So he said, you know, just go write another book. You came so close this time. And I am a big believer in hard work. And so I thought, no problem. I had to go back to my job, but I wrote the second book between like 4 a.m. and 7 a.m. every day. And in another year, I had another book and I sent it off to my agent. And I thought, this is great, because this is like, they might as well just mail me the check. Like, right now. And then instead of getting a check in the mail, I got an email from that agent telling me on my 30th birthday, like right before I went out to dinner, saying that not only was the book unsellable, but it was unsalvageable.
Oh, that's evil.
It was horrible. I will never forget that moment. It was horrible.
What does it feel like to work so hard and so long on something and then have to just chuck it? That's not something I feel like that happens in most jobs.
No, it doesn't. And I appreciate you saying that, Sarah. So there are certain weird things about being a writer. And one is that there's just one thing you're working on for so long. You know, it's not like you've got multiple projects and it's just this one thing. So it was horrific, particularly because I was so new to the process, right? Like now that would be horrible, but actually not that surprising. I mean, I've written lots of things that have been discarded or didn't go anywhere. And I understand now so clearly that that is part of the process. And I'm not afraid of that. You just have to know that. And like, I don't know if you've read Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic book, but she has a great thing where she talks about like every job has its crappy part. And she calls it some expletive sandwich, that you have to be willing to just deal with that part of it. And I think that that's it for writing. You know, like sometimes you're going to make things and they're just going to go in the trash.
That's the very worst part about writing for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are so many worst parts. That's one of the worst parts. Again, there are many challenging parts. That's one. But I have to remind, honestly, I remember that thing Elizabeth Gilbert said at the low points. I mean, it's hard to work so long, even on a book that comes out, honestly, and it's just this one moment. You have so little control over that. You have so little control over how a book is received by any given reader, by the public at large, whether or not it gets reviewed, how it gets reviewed. Like, these are not things you have control over, and whether or not it's understood the way you intended it. There are a lot of tricky parts of it. And there's a lot of, like, obviously amazing, magical parts of it. And I also think, you know, there's challenges to the job generally. Like, it's like having your own business. So you never really leave it. That makes it hard. That said, if I have an emergency, if I have I can just put it down and go, like, I have a lot of control over my, not over the long-term deadlines, but over my day to day. By and large, I have a lot of control, so much more control than, you know, 99% of other people with jobs. So
absolutely.
That's lucky. But knowing that you might have to throw something away, then it was just inconceivable to me. But I will say that that setback so early on was really good because it made me realize that this way I was trying to do this thing, which was like with a stopwatch going, like, I'm just going to real quick become a published author. It's like just not the way to go about it. And that is a big piece of advice I always give, like, aspiring writers, particularly like students and people thinking about doing it, like, set up your life so you can be in it for the long haul. Because just because you don't succeed right away doesn't mean, first of all, you may never succeed and you may be very gifted. You know, that's right. Luck is a huge component of all of this. But you need to set up a system in your life where you can keep doing it. Because also, not only is it just luck of the draw, there's a lot of rejection, but you get better over time. So you have to allow yourself the space. Some creatives, they just, their first book is actually their best one. I don't know if you've heard about that, like Picasso, Cezanne comparison, but like right. Picasso just, you know, came out perfectly at the beginning and Cezanne took years. So depending on what type of creative person you are, but it can just take a long time to get good at it, which was true for me, like just revisiting that not nice email I got, which was devastating. His assessment of that book was correct. That book was garbage. It was terrible. Terrible, terrible. Like, I should have not only burned the book, I should have burned the whole apartment. So he wasn't wrong about that. But from there, then I was like, all right, I got to give myself more time. So I gave myself a decade. And by then, luckily, I was married. My husband was willing to be in it with me and support me financially, which, again, I'd like to tell people because that made that possible for me.
One of my things I wondered about you was with your risk tolerance, you're now in this risky career. And how have you been able to do that with what is a low risk tolerance? And I know that I have a low risk tolerance too.
Yeah, it's not easy. You know, it's a process. Again, that actually, if you would, you say, which is the like crap sandwich I'm eating in this job? Like for me personally, it's that. It's that I have no control over this. I really don't. And no amount of hard work, because I really am, again, big believer in this, like I'm just going to work 10 times harder than like anybody else. And that's going to really make the difference. It does, sure. It makes some difference, but it does not make all of the difference at all in this career. So occasionally I'm like, oh, you know, that this is really the sucky part of this job. And it is hard because it really, I also tell people that who are aspiring, like, yes, the leap from unpublished to published, I'm not going to deny that's a big line you get over and then you have a published book and that's a really big deal. But the challenges of it never really go away. I mean, it's every book. It's different every time, the shape a publication of a book takes, and it continues to be hard. But I do think in that, if you can understand that and accept it, there lies freedom to some extent, because you've got to focus on the art. Because the art and the making of the book is the one thing you will always have control over. So I am always happiest, I have to say, in the making of the books.
Right.
Than I am in the rest of it. Because when you're in the story, like, first of all, I'm living in this other world, which is this, like, incredible experience, but you own all of that. And like, it's just incredibly kinetic. And that's what keeps me coming back, is that. And there are crappy parts of the writing process, I'm not going to deny that. But there's this just incredibly addictive quality to the making of a book. So whenever I get down, I try to focus on that part.
So after putting in 10 years, and it was it actually 10 years between your first book that did not sell and then selling Reconstructing Amelia?
I think it was 11.
11. So how did that feel after having put in 10 long years, 11 long years? What was the moment like when you found out that Reconstructing Amelia had sold?
I didn't believe it. It was sold at auction.
Oh, wow. So you had a fight over it.
Yeah, there were 6 publishing houses, and there was a day that went by where I was getting emails about, it was like, I don't know, they called a round robin or something, where people are calling in with like offers and whatever. And
it's like the draft.
Yeah, exactly. And then I ended up with kind of 2 offers I was deciding between in the end of the day. And so I didn't believe it because there's a huge delay until you get the contract. And now I know that's like nothing. contracts take forever. And you, I mean, obviously things could happen theoretically, but you have a deal. Right before they went to auction, I had finally gotten a job offer. I had started to look for a job and I'd finally gotten a job offer at being in the writing department, writing the communications department at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. So I was going to have to commute to Philadelphia every day. I remember asking my agent at the time, are you sure I can turn down this job? Like, I did not believe her that the book had actually sold. I think it was until I signed the contract. To be honest, there are still days I really don't believe any of this is happening.
That is such a sliding doors moment. I mean, what if your offer had come like 2 months later?
It really was one of the most kind of remarkably kismet moments of my life. I mean, or probably the most. It was a really just kind of crazy, crazy thing.
Oh, I love that story. That gives everybody hope and just to keep working hard and things could go.
Absolutely. I do think that piece about hard work and like listening to feedback and really being willing, not just trying to continue to assert your greatness and your genius, but continuing to commit yourself to getting better, which I always was. I read reviews from readers all over the place, all the time.
My review of your book came out this morning.
Oh, did it? Okay, I'll have to. I'm excited.
Let's get to the book.
Yes.
So I dug deep on the internet and I found this interview that you had done with the blog for Books A Million, which that can tell everybody how old this is. May 2016, you were quoted as saying, after that, I have another adult book coming from Harper. I haven't started working on that one yet, but I know the basic story. It will be set back in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and will involve the violent rape of a prominent woman in the community. And it's going to have an awesome twist. This is not exactly what good marriage is, right? It's a death rather than the rape. So how did you evolve from idea number one to idea number two? And I'm so curious how authors end up changing course like that.
First of all, what I have to say is Sarah did share with me that link to that interview in advance of this conversation, which I appreciated because I was like, what is she talking about? I was like, wait, first of all, what is chapters? I was like, what is any of this? What is she talking about? So I clicked on it and I literally, it was like one of those talking like an out of body moment. I was like, wait, what did I say? Like, when was this? I honestly can't completely, I spent a lot of time. It was like a lovely thing for you to say. Cause I was like, oh, like it was like this time machine. I was like, what was I thinking then when I wrote that?
Yeah.
I think at the time, the thing about this book, which is a weird thing about publishing, is this, A Good Marriage, was actually sold in 2014 because it was sold before as I had just sold the YA books and then I sold this book. So originally there was some thought that this book was going to be written in the middle of the YA books, which was not possible for me to do. Just intellectually, I could not, that's not something I could do. So it ended up getting pushed until now. So
you sold it before it was written?
Yes.
That's nice. You've gotten to a good place in your career now.
Yeah. So I sold it before it was written, but I even sold it before there was a clear concept. It's not so unusual to sell a book before it's written once you've had books, but to sell a book with no, like even anything. So I think by then I had asked for an extension and I had to write like a paragraph. They're like, okay, well, if we're going to give you an extension, we'd like to at least have some idea what the book is.
What are we extending for?
Right, exactly. What are we extending you? Yeah, exactly. I think that was what I came up with. But what is truly fascinating, so I looked at that and I was like, oh, I do vaguely remember that. Like I knew, and this is what's really interesting about my process, is it's really like feeling around in the dark for a while. I'm like, okay, I think it's this. I knew it was going to be back in Park Slope. I knew it was going to be a wife and mother that had something happened to her or whatever. And then it evolved from there, right? So then the idea, it became a paragraph. Then I got an extension. I didn't revisit really beginning it until I began it, which was when I was done writing the last of the Outliers trilogy, which was like beginning of 2018. I didn't really think exactly, begin to come up with the characters or come up with the spine or what have you. I knew I wanted it to be about marriage. I think even back then, although I didn't mention that in that article. But what's really fascinating is that I am developing an idea for something that could be a sequel to A Good Marriage. And that is the storyline, which is crazy because I didn't, that's what the crazy thing about writing. And that's what I'm like, it's magic because I didn't know that. Meaning I have stuff in writing about this new idea. And then you pointed that out and I was like, oh my God, that's so weird. Like I, somewhere that was in my consciousness before, but I had no recollection of it.
So everything's coming full circle and there will be a sequel. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. My editor's listening now. It's not my next book. My next book is a different book.
Okay.
But I have an idea for, I think that Lizzie could be a really great recurring character.
I loved her.
I'd really like to bring her back. And so that's my idea, pivots around that.
Oh, that is so interesting. Okay, well, we're going to all be waiting with bated breath for that.
Awesome.
And obviously, we have to talk about marriage.
Yes.
I loved how you explored, in the frame of kind of a mystery thriller, this deeper concept, because I read a lot of literary fiction about marriage. I love that you brought that element to a suspense novel. And I love how you looked at what makes one marriage successful versus another marriage, and they're not necessarily the same thing. And some couples will willingly and gladly tolerate certain things that other couples absolutely would never tolerate. So why marriage in this book? And then also, how did you come up with all of the different kind of archetypes? Because there were a lot. There was like the cold transactional marriage and sort of the sexually open marriage. And then there was the marriage that was dealing with addiction. How did you decide on sort of each of the types you were going to explore?
First of all, thank you for that kind of description of what I was doing, because as I said, there's kind of not gratifying moments and then there are gratifying moments. And you did read the book the way I intended it.
Oh, good. Did I get it? I get what you were trying to say. Okay, wonderful.
Yes, you heard me. So that's good. I really did know I wanted to write a book about marriage. I mean, Reconstructing Amelia is kind of a book about motherhood. This is my book about marriage, my next book about friendship. And I really start with that central theme. And I've been married 18 years myself, but I was a child of a divorce. So I never was in a house with a marriage.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So for me, marriage is like, and I actually feel this way about motherhood too, because my background, but it's a little like, what is this thing we're doing?
Did you have marriages that you were close enough to as a child to kind of watch? Or did you kind of really, your first experience was your own marriage?
Yes, my own marriage, my first experience, for sure. So I'm always kind of like examining it. And now that we've been married a long time, our friends have obviously been married a long time. And nothing fascinates me more than how different everybody's marriage seems. And, you know, the balance of power is different and how people express affection is different. And I find that endlessly fascinating. So much so that, like, you know, we'll go out with a couple and they'll be like bickering at dinner. And I come home and I'm like, so do they hate each other like for real? Or do they just, is that just their thing? And you really can't predict, because then there'll be another couple that seems completely happy and they end up divorced, right? So, and then you start to be like, well, but what is happy? Because, I mean, maybe it's just that those couples that are staying together and are bickering aren't happy, but they just stay together. Merely staying together, of course, is not the measure either. So what is the measure? You take two people in a marriage, each one of those people has their own definition of happiness, right? Which might not be the same. And then you have a marriage, which really becomes this like living thing between two people. And it changes over time. You know, if you've been married a long time, you have one marriage when you get married, then you have kid little babies, and that's one thing. And then it changes yet again. And you both change over time. So like, can your marriage, you know, change with you? I think those are all really endlessly fascinating questions. And I think that in terms of writing, yes, this is a thing that's often looked at in literary fiction. I'm always going to write the kind of book that I write. So like someone's always going to end up dead just because that's the kind of story I'm interested in. I'm really interested in the why of things happening. So, but I really care first and foremost about this central question, like, and that is what I go in looking to look at. And then the rest of it becomes this kind of fun puzzle I build around it. So I really cared not about the secrets. I think there's been a lot of mysteries written, wonderful ones, about the secrets like a husband and a wife keep from each other, right? And what happens, and he's not who you thought he was, and blah, blah, blah. And those are some great books that do that. But I was like, but what instead about the secrets that couples keep from the world? And not like we have dead bodies in our basement, but even unintentional ones. There's so much about marriage that I feel like you're hurtling through life, right? Like you've got careers, you've got kids, you've got all these things. And I feel like a marriage oftentimes becomes this like river, like underneath it, and that you're rarely looking at. You're just skating on top of. And so I just really wanted to examine that and examine the consequences of that, which also kind of becomes this kind of secrecy that runs so deep that often you don't realize it yourself. So that was kind of the lead into that. In terms of the different characters being kind of archetypes of marriage, and you're exactly right, the ones that you call out. Usually, again, I have this theme and then I don't outline anything. So then I'm coming up with my characters and I figure out the two main ones. the main one first, and then usually the person who had something happen to them, and then the guy post in, which in this case is Lizzie, the lawyer. And from there, slowly the other characters and their types of marriages they have evolved. I definitely did want different couples to represent different aspects of marriage, and also to, in my view, examine what is so much of these kind of golden rules about marriage that are such fallacies. And, you know, you should never argue. You should always be honest. Fidelity is absolutely required. And I think that all of those are true for some people and completely not true for other people. It's just a much more complicated question than I think we as a society are led to believe. What makes a good marriage is an endlessly complicated question.
Especially in the scenes where you had sort of the girlfriends together, I could just picture being in conversations with my friends, because absolutely, I have friends who I would never be able to be in a marriage like theirs, and probably vice versa, you know?
Right.
It is endlessly interesting to analyze all of that social dynamic stuff. So you live in Park Slope, and it seems like a really fascinating place. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to live there? Is it just like it is in the book? Are there people like the characters in the book there? Are there sex parties?
Just the ones at my house, Sarah. You know, I love my neighborhood. Like, I always try to make that clear. It really is meant in part to be a love letter to my neighborhood. So is Reconstructing Amelia. I realized after I wrote it that not everyone saw it that way. They were like, wait, so the bullying must be terrible in Park Slope. And I was like, wait, no. It is a very special, unique place. We're not in Manhattan. So it is very, very much a small town in a way that you really, given the density and the number of people, is hard to believe. There are people I know that I have recognized for years and years. I know how old their children are. I know who they're married to, like quirks of their personality. And I don't know their name. Like, I don't know who they are.
It's like the person that you share a workout class with every week.
Totally. Right. Exactly.
But you don't know their name.
Exactly. So I've lived here for 16 years. So you really, it's like being on a college campus. You know, you're like, oh, you want to avoid somebody, you like have to cross to the other side of the street. You recognize it's a really small town. And that in an urban setting is a really unusual thing. The people who live here, we've got more writers in this 11215 zip code than there are anywhere else in the country.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, writers and journalists and professors. And so it's a lot of kind of intellectual, creative, a lot of filmmakers, a lot of people like that. It's an expensive neighborhood. So it's not that these aren't like the 20-year-old artists. They're living cooler parts of Brooklyn than Park Slope. It's a unique dynamic, I think, compared to like some of the pricier parts of Manhattan, for instance, the people Park Slope attracts.
Less hedge fund managers.
Exactly, right. There's not as many bankers and that kind of thing. And also a lot of people have kids, right? So it's a very kid-dominated neighborhood, which again creates a sense of community because you're connected through your children and you'll see, be like, oh, you live here a long time. You know that person from that preschool. So anyway, so I will say that to the extent the people in the book are like opinionated and strong personalities and, you know, smart and colorful and all of those things, that's definitely Park Slope. The neighborhood gets mocked sometimes. There's like arguments over like how close the ice cream truck is parked to the playground. And, you know, the New York Post loves to write articles or the Daily News about Park Slope. And some of it's like true, you know, like, and some of it's, you know, everything taken to its extreme. But by and large, I think it makes for really incredible neighbors and really kind people. And like, it's a very passionate, committed group of people who live here who care a lot about their kids and care about their community. And they make great characters.
I was going to say it makes a very vibrant setting.
And that's why I like to write about it. And I also, though, I will say, I really do like writing kind of about my home. I mean, the places in the book are real places. And, you know, I wrote Amelia and then I took a break from writing about here for a while. And it was really nice to come home.
Yeah. Do your friends and your social circle, do they get excited when you're going to write a book about Park Slope? Or are they like, oh, don't put me in there? Or are they looking for themselves in there or anything like that?
You know, I don't know. I will say I don't spend a lot of time asking people that question.
Fair.
Maybe I'm a little afraid of the answer. I will say that my friends here are always like so supportive and great. And I think everybody takes it as it's intended with a good sense of humor. And, you know, like it's fiction, you know, and I think everybody can see the truth in it and see the exaggeration, et cetera.
Right.
But if they are thinking otherwise, they are not sharing it with me.
One last thing before we get to your book recommendations. How are you finding it working during coronavirus? Are you finding yourself able to get creative and do that creative work? Because I know for myself, I feel like my creative work takes more mentally out of me and more concentration and more, I need more peace and space to do it than the busy work. So how are you finding this during coronavirus when you're at home with everybody else?
You're absolutely right. It's definitely a challenge. I mean, for the past couple weeks, I've been doing more of the non-creative part of putting this book out in the world. So that is not as challenging. I do have a book due fairly soon. And so, you know, for the first kind of 6 weeks of quarantine, I was working on that. And it's very, very difficult. The way I've been dealing with it is was getting up and like basically like 3 o'clock in the morning and working very, very early.
While everybody else is asleep.
Yeah, because it's if you need peace and space, which I do. And again, I don't work at home at all, even when they're not here.
Right.
And I think everyone, this is not to say that everyone should be out there working. I think everyone's got to deal with this time in the way that causes them the least anxiety. So whatever makes you feel good, I feel like you should do. For me, working makes me feel better. As I said, like the creation process is my escape and causes me less anxiety to know that I don't feel frozen as much in this moment. So I've been doing my best. Again, there's been this kind of hiatus as the book has come out, but I will be getting back to it and I'm just going to have to figure it out, I guess.
As we all will, for sure. And can you tell us anything about your next book? Any broad synopsis outline or?
Yes, it involves a group of friends from college. They're in their 30s now. They all live in New York City. One of them is kind of having some trouble. So they head upstate for the weekend to the Catskills, to the weekend house of one of them. And they kind of have to share this troubled past. And once they're up in the Catskills for the weekend, they run afoul of some locals and violence erupts. But as the weekend progresses, they begin to realize that, you know, begin to question whether or not the threat is actually these kind of outsiders or if it lies closer to home. So it's really about friendship and it's got a really cool different structure. It unfolds over this weekend. So you're kind of, there's one time frame that is what happened. And then again, there's this kind of outsider looking into what happened after it's already happened. So it's got a very cool structure that I'm excited about.
That sounds amazing. I can't wait for it. I love books about college friends later in life because I feel like college ends and people just scatter. And like, how do those relationships then evolve? I think that's a period in people's lives that isn't written about quite as much as other periods, but I find it a particularly fascinating period.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. Again, like it's a look at friendship, which is something that's really important to me, but I haven't really fully, it's been on the sidelines in every book, but this is kind of like a direct look at it.
Oh, well, I'm excited.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, let's get to your book recommendations. As usual, Kimberly is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she does not love, and one upcoming release that she is excited about. Tell me about your first old book.
Okay, The Hours, Michael Cunningham.
Yes.
Yes, one of my favorite books of all time. If not, I'm not going to say the favorite, but to me, the structure was just masterful and so moving and beautiful and spare, you know, and just to me, it was like a work of genius. And when I read it, I remember being like, oh my God, you can tell a story this way. And of course, that kind of fractured narrative has been done many times before. Sound and the Fury, I mean, it's been done many times, but there was something about the way he did it for me that was just so enlightening and encouraging because I felt like it was in the vicinity of what I had been trying to do.
And did you see the movie?
I did.
Did you like one better than the other?
You know, I really loved the movie also. Of course, it's got my beloved Nicole Kidman in it.
Right.
I don't really look at things like, is it a faithful adaptation? I think I look at it like a separate piece of art. And so I just remember thinking it was a fantastic movie.
I have not read The Hours. I know.
Do that.
We're going to talk about this in a little bit. I have an aversion to the classics. And I think also things that are tangentially related to the classics. So I know this is sort of related to Virginia Woolf, and Virginia Woolf is a character in the book. And I get scared of those things, but I've heard so many good things about it. And I've heard the writing is beautiful.
It really is. And obviously, like Virginia Woolf plays a role in Amelia too. So I do feel like there's this kind of karmic connection to it. Yeah. So it's not what you think it is. So you should read it.
All right. I might give it a shot. It's not long. So that's a step in the right direction for me.
Exactly.
That was The Hours by Michael Cunningham, and that came out in 1998. Tell me about the second old book you loved.
The second is Blackout, which is a memoir by Sarah Heppala. And We didn't actually talk about this, but I am a recovered alcoholic. Yes. And in A Good Marriage, one of the characters is an alcoholic. So this blackout is Sarah Hepola's kind of journey of recognizing that she had a drinking problem and blacking out specifically. It's a remarkable book, and I don't think you have to have any issue with alcohol yourself to enjoy it. It's honest and bracing. And I think if actually, it's probably good to read, you know, if you don't have a problem with alcohol, maybe you have friends who do, like, it's such an accurate representation of the experience that it really, to me, was an incredibly brilliant and moving and honest memoir, but also just comforting. It was close to my own experience, actually. So anyway, so that book is fantastic.
I remember when that came out and I had since kind of forgotten about it. I've now added it back to my audio TBR list because I love listening to memoirs on audio.
Yeah, I actually listen to it on audio.
Oh, good.
And yeah, she reads it and she's so good at reading it. It's really good.
Did you read this or listen to this while you were still drinking or had you already quit by that point?
No, I quit drinking 16 years ago.
Wow. Congratulations. That's amazing.
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, I had long been sober, but actually, like, I just got sober on my own. I didn't do it through any sort of group or anything, which I don't necessarily recommend. That's not a shout out. Get the help you need. But anyway, so anytime I get to come across something that kind of gives me that sense of somebody, you know, community or whatever, it's nice.
Sure. And we hadn't talked about this earlier, and I was purposely trying to avoid this topic earlier because I knew we could talk about it here. How did your own experience sort of influence your writing of Sam and Lizzie's marriage?
Yeah, it was obviously different. And in fact, I was such an unbelievably high functioning alcoholic that it actually had very little negative effect in that way. Sam's drinking in A Good Marriage has a very visible negative consequences on his marriage. He loses his job. They run into financial problems. Like it's kind of the archetypical way, like an alcoholic can really damage their relationships, right? So I thought it was just useful to write about it that way because I think that's a lot of, you know, way people see it. But then to see how that she loves him anyway through it and how it's really complicated in that way and how he really is trying. I mean, I have obviously a lot of empathy for Sam as a character and personally, but also just like as a writer, I had a lot of empathy for him. And I hope that comes across in the book.
It did. My thought of him as I was reading was he is a good guy with a disease.
Yeah, exactly.
Not he's a bad guy making all these bad decisions.
Right. Well, good. I'm glad he comes across that way. That was my intent, obviously. So the core of him, that thing was very much tied to my own experience. You know, I wanted to show that. I mean, it's very simple to think, oh, you wouldn't tolerate it or you would, you know, if you were a spouse or you wouldn't do that yourself. It's just very easy to say those things, but then you're in it and it's a whole lot more complicated. But my actual experience, again, it wasn't until we were going to have children. Like I was able to be so high. I mean, I had a really, really demanding career and I had all these things. It never affected anything for me. So, which is its own dysfunction. I mean, it's its own, that's not me bragging.
It almost makes it harder to stop, I bet.
Exactly. Right. So it's its own pathology. It's its own unique pathology. It doesn't make me like a really excellent alcoholic or something. So it wasn't until I went to have children, which you get no time off. You can't compartmentalize having a baby.
You're probably not going to be a high functioning alcoholic and mother.
Exactly. Not at 2 a.m. when they, you know, are up at 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, right? Like, so like you realize that it ultimately has a limitation there.
So that was Blackout by Sarah Hepola. I'm actually in good shape on my audio TBR. So I'm going to listen to this pretty soon, I think.
Awesome.
All right. Tell me about the first new book you love.
Hidden Valley Road by Robert Kolker, who is also the author of Lost Girls, which is also a fantastic book. So Hidden Valley Road tells the story of one family with 12 children, 6 of whom were schizophrenic, which is a huge number within one family. Obviously, 12 children is a lot of children to begin with. And it also at the same time really kind of traces the history of the way schizophrenia has been treated and diagnosed over the years throughout the world. And I have mental illness in my family, so I like a personal connection to the story, but it is so masterfully written. And he really just does this seamless job of, it's so much information to cover, so much to unpack. And he does it in a way that kind of does this balance between educating you about something historical and scientific, but also telling this really intimate portrait of this one family. And it's just spectacularly good. It's Oprah's pick. She picked well.
Yes.
I really highly recommend it. As you can see, I like my nonfiction while I'm writing, but I do.
I do too.
It's fantastic. So I recommend it.
I picked this book up before it came out and I was completely fascinated by the chapters about the family, sort of the memoir-y, not memoir, because that's not accurate, but the story chapters. But I was getting bogged down in the history chapters and I was reading books for my summer reading guide. And I was like, okay, because the history chapters are a little bit more dry, this is not right for the summer reading guide. So I put it down, but I kind of want to go back to it because I've heard so many good things about it since then.
Yeah. And I think one, I was a psych major in college. So when I was reading the history part, a lot of it was ringing bells for me. You know, like I was like, oh, I remember studying that, like Jung and Freud. And like, so that was of particular interest to me, those sections. But in addition to that, having had personal experience with a family member with the illness, to see how little has changed.
Oh, wow.
In the medical community, obviously, like they have a lot of, obviously, we have a lot more knowledge about schizophrenia, but like it's a very complicated disease. And our medical establishment is just woefully unprepared. It was interesting to see how much has changed and how much has not changed.
Right. And this family was studied by scientists.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a crazy story.
That was Hidden Valley Road by Robert Kolker, and that came out in April. And the way this came on my radar was Megan Abbott, another author who I love. She had talked about it on her Instagram. So recommended by Megan Abbott as well. All right, tell me about the second new book you love.
My second recommendation is The Girl from Widow Hills, which is Megan Miranda's forthcoming book. I think it's, it comes out at the end of June. It's I mean, Megan's a fantastic thriller writer, mystery, I don't know if thriller is the right word for her books, but mystery writer. And she just does such an incredible job of balancing atmospherics and character development and really thoughtful ideas. And this book is kind of about the weight of history and how you process early trauma and what it means later in life to kind of own your own story. And it's really, really well done. Whether or not you've read Megan's previous books, I would pick it up. It's beautiful. She really is just a lovely writer and manages to balance that, I think, really well with the plot and the storytelling.
And she's also another suspense writer who writes YA.
Yes. Yeah. She started out writing YA, I think.
That was The Girl from Widow Hills by Megan Miranda. And y'all, that will be out June 23rd. So it's not out quite yet, but just a couple weeks away. Okay. Let's talk about the book you did not love. And before you share it, two authors on my podcast have shared books by this author as the books they did not love. Two different books. I'll tell you who once you share it.
Oh, good. I feel totally validated now. Yeah. And more self-righteous in my opinion. So A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by the indomitable James Joyce. And I have to say, I love you all, dear listeners, but if you are claiming to have liked this book, I don't believe you. I read the whole thing and I was like, I tried the whole time to convince myself that I loved it and that I was going to be super intellectual. And I was just like, do not love this.
Why do we do that to ourselves?
I don't know.
I mean, now as an adult, I don't do it anymore, but I definitely did when I was younger.
Oh, for sure. Because all you have is what the world is telling you is good.
All your teachers are saying these are the books that are important and da 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 da.
Right. And I have to say, sometimes I read books, or this happens with films too, and people are like, yeah, it's just such, the way that it ends and doesn't end is just a work of genius. And you're like, no, but it doesn't end. Like, it really doesn't. It doesn't have an ending. I feel often that people give too much credit sometimes, that there was an intent there where there isn't always an intent. And I say this because my first book, the one that didn't sell, absolutely, I was just like, it's so literary. And remember, this is a book that almost was purchased by a publisher. It's like, it's just super literary. And the reality was it didn't have an ending because I didn't know how to end it. But it's super literary. And that was not what I was doing. And this is not true of all literary books. But I think that there are sometimes we kind of oversubscribe meaning to things.
I feel like we're getting to see Oz behind the curtain right now.
Exactly. So anyway, so I do not like that book. And I read the whole thing and I tried to like it. So who are the other authors?
The other author is Caroline Zancan. She wrote the novel We Wish You Luck that came out this year, which was one of my favorite books of the year so far. But she shared Ulysses as the book that she did not love. And I found some really funny reviews on Goodreads that were just like, it fell in the toilet and I didn't feel like it was worth getting it out. Things like that.
Exactly. And that is fair. You're allowed to feel that way.
Yes, that is one of the joys of being an adult. We don't have to read books we don't like.
Exactly.
All right. So that was A Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. Okay. Tell me about the new release that you are excited about.
I am really excited for Morgan Jerkins' Wandering in Strange Lands. It was going to come out in May. I think the publication has been moved to August.
Yeah, August 4th was what I saw.
Okay, but yeah, because of the pandemic. So she was at a dinner that I was at, and she presented about her book. And it's just sounds like a fascinating combination of, it's what I like most and what I appreciate kind of about Hidden Valley Road, but it's a combination of a historical look at the Great Migration, Black Americans, you know, moving from the South to find jobs in cities in the North and over like a really large period of time, decades. So it's a look at that combined with a look at her personal connection to that and her own family stories. And it sounds like she did an enormous amount of research for the book. And I was really fascinated hearing her talk about, one, her personal connection, but also kind of what an achievement it was for her to do that research and really be out on the ground in these places talking to people. So I was really riveted hearing her talk about it. And I think it's going to be a really good combination, again, of really a historical, a personal look at it as well.
And the Goodreads reviews said the same thing, that it was really, really well researched. So that was Wandering in Strange Lands by Morgan Jerkins, coming out August 4th. Okay, are you ready to play Rate It?
I am.
I like to end every episode with Rate It, which is a lightning round game where I throw out five bookish things, and they could kind of be anything book related, and they have been specially selected for you, and you rate each one either one or five stars, just like you'd rate a book. All right, number one, the convention of lumping mysteries and thrillers together into one genre category.
One.
Good. Okay, that's what I was hoping you would say. Tell me why, and tell me what you think the difference is.
I don't know that I can define the difference, but you starting with the phrase lumping together sounds really bad to me. I think there's a real desire to categorize, right? Like in a way that, so maybe that's more about creating many categories, but like, I just think that my books cross over so much that I even don't love them just being called mystery thrillers, because I feel like that kind of says they're one thing and sets up a set of reader expectations. Not that I don't think mystery and thrillers aren't fantastic. I do. I wish there was a little less, the boundaries were more fluid. So I would say like a thriller implies more action, maybe, if I were to do the definition, than a mystery, which probably is more of a puzzle. By the way, my books are referred to by every suspense, mystery, thriller, domestic suspense, you know, like I hear every name being ascribed to them.
That makes sense to me, because when I was reviewing your book and talking about it, I feel like I call it something different every time, because it is a mashup. And that's what I love about it.
Yes, it's definitely a crossover for sure.
All right, number two, the comparison of A Good Marriage to Big Little Lies.
Oh, I love that.
It did remind me a little bit of Big Little Lies.
I will tell you that I had not read or watched Big Little Lies before I wrote A Good Marriage. So much so that I didn't realize the name of the coffee shop was the same almost as the name of my coffee shop.
Oh, is it?
I think it is in the book and in the show, but I changed after the fact the name of my coffee shop to something else, even though it's a real coffee shop. And I was like, what? It's like the same name.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. And then I was like, forget it. It's a real coffee shop on my corner. Like, I'm just going to put the name back. You know, I read Megan's book, but I try not to read really right in my genre, like when I'm writing, because there's like zeitgeisty ideas, right? Like we all live in culture. So like we're coming up with ideas that overlap in some ways. So I'm always afraid about inadvertently copying something. I know that I didn't read Big Little Lies or watch it before I wrote my book. And I love that I know that. But I think it's fantastic, to be clear. Like, I think Big Little Lies is fantastic and the show is fantastic. So yeah, sure. Like, who doesn't want to be compared to that?
So this is interesting for me, because I did not like the book Big Little Lies, but I loved the show because it was darker and dealt more with the parent stuff than it did with, like, the mommy school politics. And I don't love a ton of the mommy school politics stuff in my reading.
You're right. Yeah, it was darker. The show was darker.
Yeah. And I feel like A Good Marriage was, to me, more like the show.
Yes. I mean, yeah. I think just having the different couples, I think it's a community. It's a look at a community. I mean, I think the thing that makes mine very different is that it's also a legal thriller. So like there's a whole 50% of the book that is completely different.
Okay. Number three, visiting Rikers.
I think I have to give it 5 stars for the experience. I mean, this is going to be like a 5-star, 1-star kind of deal. I mean, Rikers itself is definitely like 0 stars or like negative stars. I think as an experience, it's like a 1-star, 5-star kind of thing. And I think that the experience of going to Rikers was invaluable to the writing of the book. And I couldn't have written those scenes without being there. It's just it's an experience that you have never had in your life. And it's really indescribable. You really have to feel what it's like to be there. So, and it really does look like that kind of ramshackle. I think I had a vision in my head, like it was one big prison building rather than being this like encampment of different buildings. And the fact, the whole process of getting in is such an involved process and all of that. And it was just really eye-opening, even aside from being a writer, like just as a person, to think that people are held there without bail when they haven't, you know, been convicted of anything yet, you know, people who have no money. So yeah, it was an incredible, like kind of life-changing experience.
So what happened to Zach when he is sent there, not having been really charged with much of anything? That can actually happen in real life.
Yeah, well, what usually happens is that you would be charged with something and then you wouldn't make bail, right? So, which is the big controversy that they have, like, you know, $200 cash bail for a lot of people is like, they don't have $200. And so, by the way, if your bail is $200, it means you were like selling marijuana, like meaning like that it becomes this weird self-fulfilling prophecy where people charged with very minor crimes are held there because they don't have the money to make their minor bail because they don't have a lot of money. Zach is held there because he's charged with assaulting an officer. And for reasons that become clear a little bit into the book, he's got reasons why he's denied bail. He hasn't even been charged with murder yet. So they're kind of holding him at Rikers as a way as they build their murder case against him. So that is unusual only because Zach is so affluent. So somebody like him would never be held in Rikers because they pay their bond. But it can happen. And in fact, the client that I went to see with my lawyer friend was being held there in that situation. So it can happen.
Oh. All right. On that note, number 4. Building the premise of a novel off of a real life legal case. Would you ever do that? Or would you think about doing that or no?
I would say 5, like I would do that. I have not done that. Usually it's like bits and pieces. Like you'll see if you've watched the Netflix show, The Staircase, like there is some in my book there. I mean, there's a staircase. So right. Like there's yeah. Like, you know, there's a staircase and there is evidence and you can see how the ambiguity of certain evidence plays out. So like that is an echo of that case. So I think for sure, I mean, I think I would imagine that most writers that I can't imagine doing it without filtering it through so many different lenses that it would look unrecognizable at the end and really would turn into fiction. Like I can't imagine just taking a real case and writing, that would seem risky to me and maybe potentially hurtful. Because you're finally getting to know the really what happened, which is so rare in criminal cases, like really, really to know the why, even when we find out the who and they're arrested. I mean, the inevitably unsatisfying thing is like, so rarely do you find out why somebody did something. And I think that's why I write these books, really, is to like get those answers.
That came through in A Good Marriage. Literally, I hadn't thought about it since I was actually reading and thought about it. But I got a huge kind of aha moment of like, wow, a legal case is really not about the truth at all.
No, and that is meant for sure to be part of what the book is about. There's supposed to be this parallel between how you look at the legal system and also marriage. So like everyone looks at the legal system like it's so black and white. It's about search for the truth. It's about this. It's about that. It's like there's these very clear, rigid rules. And I think that's as much a fallacy as that, you know, that what kind of marriage is perfect. You know, like I just think those rigid ideas are really a falsehood.
Kind of a scary thing to think about.
Yes.
All right. Number 5, reading thrillers for your own enjoyment.
I'm going to go with 1. I mean, it's just really hard for me to do.
The reason I asked you this is if for a person who writes thrillers, do you end up like you're going to guess everything that happens so you don't even like reading them anymore?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. I mean, again, if I get a chance like with Megan's and it's an opportunity to read an early book, like I'm obviously excited to do that. It's very hard for me not to be like looking under the hood of the car the whole time and to stop myself from doing that. It's funny. I have a good friend who writes romance novels and she has no trouble just like detaching herself and enjoying romance novels. And I'm like, oh, I know where you're trying, you know, like
what you're trying to do here. I see this device.
Yeah. And even if I'm wrong, like it doesn't matter because I'm spending the whole time trying to figure out what you're trying to do. So like, I'm not saying I can guess everything and I'm so masterful. I could be totally wrong, but I've just spent half the book doing that. And I don't like to do that. Like, I want to be just taken somewhere else.
Totally understandable. That's what I was curious about. Thank you for being here. This has been amazing.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've had the best time. I knew I would. And this has been fantastic.
Good. All right, y'all, the June Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Kimberly's picks for categories like favorite nonfiction about marriage and favorite legal mystery slash thriller, which we should not be lumping together anymore. And if you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. Next week, we will be starting the biweekly schedule for the summer, so there is no new episode next week. In 2 weeks, June 24th, Morgan Hoyt, who is known on Instagram as NYC Book Girl and also works in marketing at Avid Reader Press, will be joining me. We're going to go deep into all things books marketing, which I know is a topic y'all have wanted to hear about for a long time. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.